moderate the temperature and give the fat a chance to render before browning begins. The skin of a roast chicken or turkey will crisp up on its own as long as the bird cooks long enough for the fat to render. Duck needs a little more help, though, since it has a thicker layer of subcutaneous fat to provide the bird with energy for flying and help keep it warm in the winter months. Using a very sharp needle or metal skewer, prick the skin of the entire bird, focusing particularly on the fattiest parts, the breast and the thighs. The holes will allow the rendering fat to escape and coat the skin as it melts, leaving you with glassy, crisp skin. If roasting a whole duck is beyond your comfort zone right now, start with duck breasts. Before cooking, score the skin on both diagonals with a sharp paring knife, leaving behind a pattern of tiny diamonds. The same rendering will occur on a smaller scale, leaving the breasts with perfectly crisped skin. I'm a stickler for rendering the fat cap on pork chops and rib steaks. I hate getting a nicely cooked steak with a strip of flabby, barely cooked fat running down the side. So either start or finish the cooking process by laying a chopper steak on its side in the pan or on the grill, allowing the fat to render. This might require a little bit of balancing trickery on your part. Hold the meat in place with your tongs, or try to cleverly lean the meat up against a carefully placed wooden spoon or the edge of the pan itself. Whatever you do, don't skip this step. You won't regret taking the time to turn that strip of fat into something golden, crisp, and delicious. Smoke points. The smoke point of a fat is the temperature at which it decomposes and transforms into a visible, noxious gas. Have you ever added oil into a hot pan for sautéing vegetables and then been distracted by a ringing phone? If you've returned to an offensive, smoky scene at the stove, then the oil has surpassed its smoke point. Once, while I was trying to demonstrate the importance of preheating the pan to an intern, another cook approached me with an urgent question. By the time I addressed him and turned back to the pan, it was so aggressively hot that the second I added the oil, it hit the smoke point, turning the pan black and throwing everyone nearby into a coughing fit. In an attempt to save face, I tried to imply that I'd made the mistake on purpose, and it had been a lesson about smoke points from the start. But, blushing hard before the other cooks, I couldn't keep a straight face, and soon we all dissolved into laughter. The higher a fat's smoke point, the further it can be heated without ruining the flavor of the food cooking in it. Pure, refined vegetable oils, such as grapeseed, canola, and peanut, begin to smoke around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, making them an ideal choice for high-heat applications, such as deep or stir-frying. Impure fats don't do as well at extreme heats. The sediment in unfiltered olive oil and the milk solids in butter will begin to reach their smoke point or burn at about 350 degrees Fahrenheit, making them well suited for applications where a very high temperature isn't needed and their flavors can shine, such as oil poaching, simple vegetable sautés, pan frying fish or meat. Or use them for dishes that don't involve any heating, such as mayonnaise and vinaigrettes. Achieving crispness. Crispness results from food's contact with hot fat and water evaporating from the surface of the food. So do everything in your power to keep the pan and the fat hot when seeking a golden crust. Preheat the pan, then preheat the fat. Avoid putting more than a single layer of food into the pan, which will cause the temperature to drop drastically and steam to condense and make food soggy. Delicate foods especially suffer in these instances. Cooking in fat that's insufficiently hot will cause food to absorb the oil, resulting, for example, in unappetizingly beige, greasy fish fillets cooked through but not golden. Steaks and pork chops placed in cold fat will take so long to sear that by the time they appear to be perfectly cooked, the meat within will be well done rather than medium rare. This doesn't mean you should categorically crank the heat. If the fat is too hot, the outer surface of the food will brown and become crisp before the center has a chance to cook through. Crisp onion rings with crunchy slivers of onion that slip out on first bite, and chicken breast with burnt skin and a raw, flabby center both suffer from having been cooked at temperatures that were too high. The goal with all cooking is to achieve your desired result on the outside and inside of an ingredient at the same time. In this case, it's a crisp surface and a tender center. Add foods that take time to cook through, such as eggplant slices or chicken thighs, to hot fat, allowing a crust to form. Then reduce the heat to prevent burning and allow them to cook all the way through. I'll explain more about how to navigate between different levels of heat in the Using Heat section. Once you have achieved crispness, do your best to retain it. Do not cover or pile up crisp foods while they are still hot. They will continue to release steam. The lid will entrap steam, which will condense and drip back onto the food, making it soggy. Allow hot, crisp foods to cool off in a single layer to prevent this from happening. If you want to keep crisp foods such as fried chicken warm, set them in a warm spot in the kitchen, such as the back of the stove, until ready to serve. Alternatively, cool the chicken on a baking rack and then pop it into a hot oven for a few minutes to reheat it before serving. Creamy. One of the great alchemical wonders of the kitchen, an emulsion happens when two liquids that normally don't like to mix together or dissolve give up and join together. In the kitchen, an emulsion is like a temporary peace treaty between fat and water. The result is tiny droplets of one liquid dispersed in another, resulting in a creamy mixture that's neither one nor the other. Butter, ice cream, mayonnaise, and even chocolate. If it's creamy and rich, chances are it's an emulsion. Consider a vinaigrette, oil and vinegar. Pour the two liquids together, and the oil, being less dense, will float above the vinegar. But whisk the two liquids together, breaking them up into billions of tiny droplets of water and oil, and the vinegar will disperse into the oil, creating a homogeneous liquid with a new, thicker consistency. This is an emulsion. Yet little more than momentary bewilderment will hold together this simple vinaigrette. Left alone for a few minutes, the oil and vinegar will begin to separate or break. Use this broken vinaigrette to dress lettuce, and the oil and vinegar will unevenly coat leaves, tasting too sour in one bite and too oily in the next. In comparison, a well-emulsified vinaigrette will offer balanced flavor in each bite. When an emulsion breaks, the fat and water molecules begin to coalesce back into their own troops. In order to make an emulsion more stable, use an emulsifier to coat the oil and allow it to exist contentedly among the vinegar droplets. An emulsifier is like a third link in the chain, a mediator attracting and uniting two formerly hostile parties. Mustard often plays the role of emulsifier in a vinaigrette, while in a mayonnaise, the egg yolk itself has some emulsifying qualities. Using emulsions. Emulsions are efficient tools for enriching plain foods. A knob of butter swirled into a pan of pasta at the last moment. A spoonful of mayonnaise added into a dry, crumbly egg salad. A creamy vinaigrette drizzled over otherwise unadorned cucumbers and tomatoes for a simple summer salad. Some cooking requires you to make an emulsion. Other times, you will be handed an existing emulsion and your only job will be to keep it from breaking. Become familiar with common kitchen emulsions so you can protect their delicate bonds of cooperation. Some familiar emulsions. Mayonnaise and hollandaise. Vinaigrettes, though some are very temporary. Butter, cream, and milk. Peanut butter and tahini, once you stir in the oil. Chocolate. The ephemeral crema on top of an espresso. Achieving creaminess. Mayonnaise. Mayonnaise is an oil and water emulsion made by slowly whisking tiny droplets of oil into an egg yolk, which itself is a natural emulsion of fat and water. Fortunately, the yolk offers us a little insurance as it contains lecithin, an emulsifier with one end that likes fat and another that likes water. With vigorous whisking, lecithin connects the minuscule amount of water innate to a yolk to the oil droplets and surrounds tiny air bubbles. The two distinct ingredients integrate into a rich, unified sauce. But mayonnaise, and this is true of all emulsions, is always looking for an excuse to break or separate into the hostile groups of oil and water once again. For a basic mayonnaise, measure out, or at least eyeball the oil before you start. Choose your oil depending on how you intend to use the mayo. For spreading on a BLT or a Vietnamese banh mi sandwich, use a neutral oil such as grapeseed or canola. For aioli to serve alongside tuna confit in a niçoise salad, use olive oil. Each egg yolk will comfortably hold about 3/4 cup of oil in a stable emulsion. Since homemade mayonnaise is best when it's fresh, aim to make the smallest possible amount at a time, though any leftovers will keep in the fridge for a few days. Oil and water emulsions always work better when their ingredients are neither too hot nor too cold. If you're starting with an egg straight from the fridge, bring it up to room temperature before you start. If you're in a hurry, submerge the egg in a bowl of warm tap water for a few minutes to speed things up. Lightly dampen a kitchen towel and lay it into a small saucepan. Then set the mayonnaise-making bowl in it. The wet towel will create enough friction to keep the bowl steady and prevent spillage. Place the yolk or yolks in the bowl and start whisking, adding in the oil one drop at a time using a ladle or a spoon. Once you've added half the total volume of oil and created a relatively stable base, start to add the rest of the oil in more swiftly. If the mayonnaise grows so thick it's hard to whisk, add a few drops of water or lemon juice to thin it out and prevent it from breaking. Once you've added all the oil, turn your attention to seasoning the mayonnaise to taste. Follow these rules and you'll see that mayonnaise is difficult, but not impossible, to ruin. During one of his cooking lessons with me, Michael Pollan asked me to explain the science at work in an emulsion. I didn't really know, so I responded, "Magic keeps it together." Even now that I understand the science, I still believe there's some magic at work. Retaining creaminess, butter. One of my favorite poets, Seamus Heaney, once described butter as coagulated sunlight, which might be the most elegant and economical way to describe its special alchemy. To begin with, it's the only animal fat made without killing an animal. Cows, goats, and sheep eat grass, a product of sunlight and photosynthesis, and deliver us milk. We skim the richest cream off the top and churn it until it transforms into butter. The process is so straightforward that kids can make butter by shaking a glass jar filled with chilled cream. Remember that butter, unlike oil, isn't pure fat. It's fat, water, and milk solids all held together in a state of emulsion. While most emulsions are stable in a narrow range of temperatures, just a few degrees, butter retains its solid form from freezing temperatures of 32 degrees Fahrenheit until it melts at 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Compare this to what happens when you heat or freeze mayonnaise. It'll break quickly, and the magic of butter will become clear. This explains why butter sweats when left on the kitchen counter on a hot day. The water separates from the fat as it melts. At even warmer temperatures, in a pan over a hot burner or in the microwave, butter's fat and water will immediately separate. Melted butter, then, is a broken emulsion, hardening as it cools, never to return to its former miraculous state. Take care of its emulsion, and butter will lend creaminess to everything from jambon beurre, the classic Parisian ham and butter baguette, to chocolate truffles. The precise temperatures prescribed for butter in recipes are not arbitrary. Butter at room temperature is more pliable, allowing air to be worked into it to lighten cakes, or to combine more readily with flour, sugar, and eggs for tender cakes and cookies, or spread evenly onto a baguette only to be topped with ham. As I'll explain later, it's also important to keep butter cold in order to preserve its emulsion and prevent it from interacting with the proteins in flour when making doughs for flaky pastries, including all butter pie dough. Julia Child once remarked, "With enough butter, anything is good." Put her advice into practice by using butter to make another emulsion, butter sauce. Temperature is crucial with butter-water emulsions. The key is to start with a warm pan and cold butter. For a simple pan sauce, after removing a steak, fish fillet, or pork chop from the pan, tip out any excess fat. Place the pan back over the heat and add just enough liquid, water, stock, or wine to coat the bottom. Using a wooden spoon, scrape any delicious crusty bits into the sauce and bring it to a boil. Then, for each serving, add 2 tablespoons of very cold butter into the pan and swirl over medium-high heat, letting the butter melt into the liquid. Don't let the pan get so hot that the butter sizzles. As long as there is enough water in the sauce, you'll be fine. Once you see the sauce begin to thicken, turn off the flame and let the butter finish melting over residual heat, but don't stop swirling. Taste for salt, and if needed, add a squeeze of lemon or a splash of wine. Spoon over the food and serve immediately. The same method works for making butter water sauces to coat noodles or vegetables. Do it directly in the pasta pan, as long as it's hot enough and the butter is cold. Make sure there's enough water in the pan and swirl, toss, swirl to make the sauce and coat the pasta all at once. Add pecorino cheese and black pepper and you've got pasta cacio e pepe, the classic Roman dish that's even more delicious than macaroni and cheese. Breaking and fixing emulsions. Some emulsions will naturally break with time, and others will break if fat and water are combined too quickly. But the most common way to ruin one is to allow its temperature to swing. Some emulsions must remain cold and others warm, yet others must be at room temperature. Heat a vinaigrette and it will break. Chill a beurre blanc and it will break. Each persnickety emulsion has its comfort zone. Sometimes you seek to break an emulsion, as when you melt butter to clarify it. Other times, it's a disaster. Heat a chocolate sauce too quickly, and it will break into a greasy, undesirable mess that even I wouldn't pour over ice cream after the longest day. But, as important as it is to be careful with emulsions, ruining one isn't the end of the world, and you almost always have some recourse. If the magic holding together your mayonnaise expires and your emulsion breaks, don't worry. The best way to learn how to fix a broken mayonnaise is to break it once deliberately so you can figure out how to salvage it. Here's the mind-bogglingly simple solution. Get out a new bowl, but keep the same whisk. If you have only one bowl, scrape out the broken mayonnaise into a measuring cup with a spout, or failing that, a coffee cup, and clean the bowl. Bring the clean bowl to the sink and spoon in half a teaspoon or so of the hottest water you can coax from your tap. Using your oily, eggy whisk, start whisking the hot water maniacally until it starts to foam. Then, treating the broken mayonnaise as if it were oil, add it drop by drop, continuing to whisk with the urgency of a swimmer escaping a shark. By the time you've added half of it back, it should start to resemble a proper mayonnaise again, perfect for slathering on a lobster roll. If this fails you, then begin the entire process over with the insurance a new egg yolk provides and add the broken mayonnaise back in a drop at a time. In the future, if, while whisking together any emulsion, you notice things start to head south, keep these tips in mind. First, as soon as you suspect that you are on shaky ground, stop adding fat. If the emulsion isn't thickening and the tines of the whisk aren't leaving visible tracks, then for heaven's sake, stop adding oil. Sometimes all that's called for at this point is a good strong whisking to bring things back together. You can also add a few chips of ice along with the first whiffs of doubt. If you don't have ice on hand, a tiny splash of cold water from the tap will suffice to regulate temperature and keep the peace. Flaky and tender. Two proteins in wheat, glutenin and gliadin, comprise gluten. When you combine wheat flour and liquid to make dough or batter, these proteins link up with one another into long chains. As dough is kneaded or batter is mixed, the chains develop into strong, extensive webs, or the gluten network. The expansion of these webs is called gluten development, and it's what makes a dough chewy and elastic. As gluten develops, dough becomes chewier. This is why bread bakers use flours with relatively high protein content and work hard to knead doughs for long periods of time to create crusty, chewy country loaves. Salt also preserves the strength of the gluten network. That's why the mixer strained with effort when I belatedly added the salt to my pizza dough as a young cook at Chez Panisse. But pastry chefs generally seek tender, flaky, and moist textures, so they do everything they can to limit or control gluten development, including using low-protein flours and avoiding overkneading. Sugar and acids, such as buttermilk or yogurt, also discourage gluten from developing, so adding them early on will tenderize pastries. Too much fat can also inhibit gluten networks from forming. By coating individual gluten strands, fat prevents them from sticking to one another and lengthening. This is where the term shortening comes from, because gluten strands remain short instead of lengthening. Four main variables will determine the texture of any baked goods, and some non-baked ones such as pasta. Fat, water, yeast, and how much the dough or batter is kneaded or worked. Refer to the illustration in the accompanying PDF. The particular way and degree to which fat and flour are blended together, along with the type of flour and type and temperature of the fat, will also affect a pastry's texture. Short doughs are the epitome of tenderness, crumbling and melting in your mouth. Here, flour and fat are blended together intimately, resulting in a smooth, homogeneous dough. Many of the shortest recipes, such as shortbread cookies, call for very soft or even melted butter in order to encourage this now fluid fat to quickly coat individual flour particles, preventing gluten webs from forming. These doughs are often soft enough to press into the pan. Rather than crumbling, flaky doughs break apart into flakes when you take a bite. Think of classic American pies and French galettes, with crusts sturdy enough to hold up to a mile-high pile of apples or juicy summer fruits, but delicate enough to produce thin, uneven flakes when sliced. To create that strength, some of the fat is worked into the flour, and a minimal amount of gluten is developed. To achieve the signature flakes of a perfect pie or galette crust, the fat must be very cold so that some of it can remain in distinct pieces. Roll out a properly made pie dough and you'll see the chunks of butter. When you slide the pie into a hot oven, the cold pieces of butter and trapped air and steam from the water released by the butter all push apart the layers of dough to create flakes. The flakiest pastries are made with laminated doughs. Picture the flakes on your plate or shirt after you've eaten a classic puff pastry, such as a cheese straw, pommier, or a strudel. It's a mess! A pile of gorgeous, classy shards. To achieve this texture, a flaky dough is wrapped around a large slab of butter. This dough and butter sandwich is rolled out and then folded back upon itself in a process called a turn. Classic puff pastry, when turned 6 times, will have precisely 730 layers of dough separated by 729 layers of butter. Upon entering a hot oven, each one of those distinct layers of butter will turn to steam, creating 730 layers of flakes. It's crucial when making laminated doughs that the fat and workspace remain cold so that the butter does not melt, though the butter must be soft enough to roll into a slab. Yeasted doughs, kneaded to develop gluten and then treated in this way, can yield laminated breads that exist at that precarious intersection of chewiness and flakiness, including croissants, Danishes, and the Breton specialty called Queen Amand. Achieving tenderness, shortbread cookies and cream biscuits. Shortbread cookies should be tender with a fine sandy crumb. This texture is the result of incorporating fat into flour early in the dough making process. My favorite shortbread recipe calls for butter so soft it's spreadable like mayonnaise, so that the fat can readily coat flour particles and keep gluten strands from developing. Use any soft or liquid fat, including cream, creme fraiche, softened cream cheese, or oil to coat flour and achieve tender textures. In classic recipes for cream biscuits, cold whipping cream functions as both the fat and the liquid binder, quickly coating the flour and obviating the need for additional water to develop the gluten network. Achieving flakiness, pie dough. Guided by lore almost as much as science, the rules of making flaky pastry appeal to my old wives' tale loving heart. Stories of pastry chefs landing jobs due to their cold hands are commonplace, since it's so important to keep the fat for flaky pastry dough chilled. While there's little evidence to prove that rumor, there's plenty to support pastry chefs' compulsion to keep everything cold. They work on cool marble countertops and freeze their mixer bowls and metal tools. One pastry chef with whom I worked for years even insisted on making her doughs in a freezing cold kitchen. With a sweater and puffy vest layered over her chef's coat, she'd get to work 2 hours before anyone else, then rush to mix her doughs before the rest of us arrived and lit the ovens, stove, and grill. She made every decision with temperature in mind, and it paid off. Her pastries were ethereally flaky. Cold-handed or not, consider temperature when you seek flakiness to create layers of developed gluten interspersed by pockets of fat. The warmer, and hence softer, your butter, the more readily it will combine with the flour. Because fat inhibits gluten development, the more intimately the two ingredients combine, the more tender, not flaky, a dough will be. To prevent gluten from developing, keep butter cold. This will protect the delicate bonds of its emulsion while you mix and roll dough. Butter contains about 15 to 20% water by weight. If butter softens and melts as it's worked into the dough, its emulsion will break, releasing that water. Water droplets will bind with the flour, developing into long gluten strands that will cause the dough's delicate layers to stick together. If they're stuck together, they can't steam apart and flake as they bake. The pastry will emerge from the oven chewy and elastic. Vegetable shortening, Crisco for example, is more forgiving of rising temperatures than butter and will remain in solid form even in a warm kitchen. But it just doesn't taste as good. By the time it reaches body temperature, butter melts away, leaving behind its rich, satisfying flavor as the tongue's lone souvenir. In contrast, the same chemical qualities that make shortening more stable at warm temperatures keep it from melting away at body temperature, leaving an unpleasant plasticky residue on the tongue. I prefer not to sacrifice flavor for the forgiveness that shortening offers. There is a trade-off. Certain measures must be taken to achieve a buttery pie crust flaky enough to shatter at the lightest touch of a fork. At home, chill the diced butter, flour, and tools in the freezer before you start, in order to encourage the butter to remain in distinct chunks even as you work it into the dough. Work quickly to reduce the threat of it softening. Don't overmix. And finally, ensure that the dough spends plenty of time chilling in the fridge between the steps of mixing, rolling, assembling, and baking. I find it easiest to make pastry dough in advance and keep it tightly wrapped in the freezer, where it can stay for up to 2 months. That cuts down the most time-intensive step, freeing me to make and bake my pie when the fancy strikes. It's important to slide the chilled, assembled pie directly into a preheated oven. In a hot oven, the water contained in the butter will quickly evaporate. The steam will push apart layers of dough as it expands with heat, yielding the flakes we so prize. If the oven's not sufficiently hot, the water won't evaporate and the crust won't set before the filling seeps in, and the pie will emerge from the oven disappointingly soggy. Achieving flakiness and tenderness. Tart dough. Prone to bouts of overindulgence at the farmer's market, I tend to find myself with more produce at any given moment than I know I can use up. You try saying no to ripe Santa Rosa plums, perfectly sweet tart nectarines, and juicy boysenberries, which always come into season on exactly the same day. With an understanding of the science of fat, my friend Aaron Hyman sought to develop a tart dough that's structured yet delicate. His ideal dough would stand up to mounds of juicy summer stone fruit but still yield flaky shards when bitten. He wanted a crust that would be both flaky and tender. And I wanted a crust that I could bake any time I had extra fruit on hand. First, he thought about how to achieve flakiness. He decided to keep everything cold, use large chunks of butter, and mix the dough just enough to form a small amount of gluten for the flaky layers. Then, to achieve tenderness, he selected liquid fats to bind the dough, cream and creme fraiche, and to coat the remaining loose flour with fat to prevent further gluten development. Aaron's method is foolproof. I've always struggled with pastry dough, but his recipe leads me to success every time. With Aaron's tart dough in the freezer, a regal dinner is always within reach. Stockpile several discs of dough for the moment when you want to invite friends over and have little more in the pantry than a basket of aging onions, a Parmesan rind, and a can of anchovies. Or when you realize you've committed to bringing dessert to a party but doubt you have the time to make anything special. Or when you go a little overboard at the farmer's market. Tart dough is the key to making something out of nothing. Tender cakes. For years, I was disappointed by almost every single cake I tasted, whether I'd baked it myself or ordered it in a restaurant or bakery. I dreamed of a cake that was moist yet flavorful. So many cakes were one or the other, Store-bought cake mixes yielded the texture I was after but were relatively flavorless, and cakes from fancy patisseries were rich in flavor but often dry or dense. I figured it was an either-or situation, and I resigned myself to it. Then I tasted a chocolate birthday cake so moist and rich that I nearly fainted from delight. For days, that slice of cake haunted me, so I begged my friend for the recipe. She called it chocolate midnight cake for how darkly rich it was, and when she shared the recipe, I noticed it was made with oil and water rather than butter. When I tasted the fresh ginger and molasses cake at Chez Panisse for the first time a few months later, I was stunned by its perfectly moist texture and deep, spicy flavor. I begged for its recipe, too, and noticed that it was eerily similar to my friend's. There was something to these oil cakes. I flipped through my mental recipe box and realized that many of my favorite cakes, including carrot cake and olive oil cake, are made with oil instead of butter. Even cake mixes, which produce the ideal texture I'd been trying to emulate, direct you to add oil. What is it about oil that yields such moist cakes? Science holds the answer. Oil efficiently coats flour proteins and prevents strong gluten networks from forming, much like soft butter does in shortbread. Gluten development requires water, so this oil barrier significantly inhibits gluten formation, leading to a tender rather than chewy texture. As an added bonus, less gluten means more water in the batter, and ultimately, a moister cake. Once I discovered the secrets of oil cake, I could anticipate the qualities of a particular cake without even trying the recipe. If oil was listed among the ingredients, I knew the recipe would yield the signature moist texture I loved so much. But there were times I craved a buttery cake, too. Rich flavor rather than a moist texture took priority in cakes I wanted to enjoy in the afternoon with a cup of tea or serve to friends at brunch. Emboldened by my discoveries about texture, I began to wonder if I could make a better butter cake. The answer lay not in treating butter like oil and melting it, but rather in capitalizing on butter's incredible capacity for lightness. Light. Lightness might not be the first quality you associate with fat, but its remarkable capacity to entrap air when whipped allows it to act as a leavening or raising agent in cakes and transform liquid cream into billowy clouds. Some classic cakes have no chemical leavening, that is, baking soda or baking powder, and rely entirely on whipped fat for their cloud-like structure. In pound cake, whipped butter and eggs do all of the work of leavening. In Genoise, a type of sponge cake, whipped eggs, whose fatty yolks entrap the air and protein-rich whites surround air pockets, allow the cake to rise. This is the only leavener. There is no baking powder, no baking soda, no yeast, and not even any creamed butter to help this cake rise. It is miraculous. Achieving lightness, butter cakes and whipped cream. When seeking rich flavor and a fine velvety crumb, make a butter cake or chocolate chip cookies, but take care to aerate this fat by creaming or whipping butter with sugar to trap air bubbles for leavening. Typically, cool room temperature butter is beaten together with sugar for 4 to 7 minutes until the mixture is light and fluffy. When done correctly, the butter will act as a net, entrapping millions of tiny air bubbles throughout the mixture. The key is to work air in slowly so that many consistently tiny bubbles form and you don't create too much heat through friction. It might be tempting to crank up the mixer so you can get the cake into the oven sooner, but trust me, that'll take you nowhere good, fast. I speak from experience. The road to this chapter is lined with dense, fallen cakes. As you mix, monitor the butter's temperature. Remember, butter is an emulsion, and if it gets too warm, it will melt and the emulsion will break, or it simply won't be rigid enough to continue trapping air. You'll lose all the air you worked so hard to entrap. If butter is too cold, air won't be able to get in, not evenly at least, and the cake won't rise straight up. And if fat isn't properly aerated, chemical leavening won't make up for it. Baking soda and powder don't introduce any new air bubbles into a batter. They simply help expand, via the release of carbon dioxide gas, air bubbles already in place. Incorporating ingredients delicately is important for the same reason. If you go to great lengths to whip air into your fat, then carelessly combine the cake's dry and wet ingredients all at once, you'll lose all of the air you whipped up. This is where folding, the technique of gently combining aerated ingredients into non-aerated ingredients, becomes important. Try to fold using light movements with a rubber spatula in one hand while spinning the bowl with the other hand. Though the chemistry behind whipped cream is slightly different than that of whipped butter, it must be very cold to begin with, the concept at work here is the same. Fat surrounds air bubbles. As cream is whipped, solid fat droplets in the liquid break open and join together. Remember that cream is a natural emulsion. Over whipped cream and the fat droplets will warm up and continue to stick to one another, making the cream unappetizingly chunky. Whip it further, and cream's emulsion will break, yielding a watery liquid, buttermilk, and solid fat, butter. Using fat. Only on the most special occasions do Persian meals end with dessert, so we never did much baking at our house. Plus, Maman, a health fiend, denied us excess sugar at every turn, though that did little more than encourage my brothers and me to develop fervent sweet tooths. If we wanted cookies or cake, then we had to make them ourselves, and Maman did her best to ensure it'd be an uphill battle the whole way. She didn't equip the kitchen with either a stand mixer or a microwave for softening butter, and she stored all the extra butter in the freezer. When it hit, the craving for cookies or cake was always urgent. I was never patient enough to wait for frozen butter to come up to room temperature, as every single recipe commanded. And even if I did somehow summon the discipline required to wait for butter to soften, without an electric mixer to help cream it, my cookie dough was always a mess, somehow completely overworked and undermixed at the same time, with huge pieces of unincorporated butter. As a typical teenage know-it-all, I knew I was way more clever than any recipe writer. So I figured I could just melt the butter for my baking on the stove and forego the softening and creaming processes completely. Melted butter was a heck of a lot easier to stir into cookie dough with a wooden spoon, after all, and it sure made cake batter nice and pourable. What I didn't know then was that by melting the butter, I was destroying any chance I had at working air into it. My cookies and cakes always emerged from the oven disappointingly flat and dense. At an age when my primary goal in baking was to eat something, anything, sweet, this was a minor problem. My brothers and I hungrily gobbled up whatever came out of the oven. As an adult with a slightly more discerning palate, I'm going for more than just a hit of sugar. I want my desserts, and frankly, everything I cook, to be uniformly delicious, with the ideal texture and flavor. You probably do too. All it takes is a little forethought. Layering fats. Since fats have such a powerful impact on flavor, most dishes will benefit from the use of more than one kind. This is what I call layering fats. In addition to considering the cultural appropriateness of a particular fat, think about whether it will harmonize with the other ingredients in a dish. For example, if you're planning to finish a fish dish with butter sauce, use clarified butter to cook the fish so that the two fats will complement each other. Pair blood oranges with creamy avocado in a salad, then drizzle everything with agrumato olive oil to amplify the citrus flavor. For perfectly crisp waffles, melt butter to add to the batter, but brush the hot iron with fat that's rendered out of the breakfast bacon. Sometimes you'll need to use multiple fats to achieve different textures within a single dish. Deep fry crisp pieces of fish in grapeseed oil, and then use olive oil to make a creamy aioli to serve alongside it. Use oil to make a supremely moist chocolate midnight cake, then slather it in buttercream frosting or softly whipped cream. Balancing fat. As with salt, the best way to correct overly fatty food is to rebalance the dish, so the solutions are similar to when you oversalt. Add more food to increase total volume, add more acid, water it down, or add starchy or dense ingredients. If possible, chill the dish Let the fat come to the surface and solidify, then skim it off. Alternatively, lift food out of a very greasy pan and dab it on a clean towel, leaving the fat behind. Foods that are too dry or need just a bump of richness can always be corrected with a little olive oil or other appropriate oil, or another creamy ingredient such as sour cream, creme fraiche, egg yolk, or goat cheese to improve the texture and get the flavor right. Use vinaigrette, mayonnaise, a soft, spreadable cheese, or creamy avocado to balance out dryness in a sandwich piled high with lean ingredients or built atop thick, crusty bread. Improvising with salt and fat. Follow the tenets I've outlined here to achieve whichever texture you're after. Then, refer to the world of fat in the accompanying PDF to guide you in evoking the flavors of wildly different places. Choose to pan-fry finger-lickin' pan-fried chicken, for instance, in clarified butter for a classic French flavor. If you're craving an Indian-inspired meal and want to dig into that jar of mango chutney in the refrigerator door, change the cooking fat to ghee. If it's a Japanese chicken cutlet you're craving, use a neutral oil studded with a few drops of toasted sesame oil. In all of these cases, the fat must be sufficiently hot to swiftly lead the browning and deliver a crisp exterior. Before you bake a birthday cake for your sweetie pie, do a little reconnaissance. Is it the moist, tender crumb of an oil cake she prefers, or the dense, velvety one of a butter cake? Since even I won't recommend improvising when you bake, let this information guide you to a recipe using the right fat to make your honey happy. With what you know about fat and what you know about salt, you'll find that you're closer to riffing than you might think. Fat has a remarkable capacity to affect texture, while salt and fat can both enhance flavor. Practice using salt and fat to improve flavor and texture every single time you cook. If you intend to finish a salad with a shower of creamy ricotta salata, hold back on some of the salt until after you taste a bite of it with its salty garnish. Similarly, when you're dicing pancetta to add richness to pasta alla matriciana, wait to season the sauce until after it's absorbed all the salt from the pork. And if a recipe for pizza dough instructs you to add salt after kneading in olive oil, think twice about following it word for word. Start to use what you know to be true to guide you through the vast forests of myth and misinformation that poorly written recipes comprise. Improvising begins with notes, and now you have two with which to compose a salt-fat melody. Master a third note, and you'll experience the transcendent harmony of salt, fat, and acid. Acid. In contrast to the revelations I experienced with salt and fat, I've learned the value of acid gradually. It started at home, with the food my mom, grandmothers, and aunts cooked each night. Maman, who'd grown up eating lemons and limes as an afternoon snack, never thought a dish tasted right unless it made her pucker. She always added a sour element to the plate to balance the sweet, the salty, the starchy, the rich. Sometimes it was a sprinkle of dried sumac berries over kebabs and rice. With kuku sabzi, a frittata packed with herbs and greens, it was a few spoonfuls of my grandmother Parivash's torshi, or mixed pickles. For Nowruz, the Persian New Year, my dad would drive down to Mexico to find sour oranges for us to squeeze ceremoniously over fried fish and herbed rice. Into other classic dishes, Maman layered gure, sour green grapes, and zereshk, the tiny tart fruits known as barberries. But mostly, we used yogurt to achieve that desired tang, spooning it over everything from eggs to soups to stews and rice. And though I wince to think of it now, spaghetti with meat sauce. I wasn't like the other kids at school. Looking at my classmates' peanut butter sandwiches next to the kuku sabzi, cucumbers, and feta Mom unpacked in my lunchbox, it was clear that my home life was dramatically different from theirs. I grew up in a house filled with the language, customs, and food of another place and time. Each year, I eagerly anticipated my grandmother Parveen's visits from Iran. I loved nothing more than watching her unpack while the room flooded with exotic aromas. Saffron, cardamom, and rosewater mingled with the humid, slightly moldy Caspian air that had tucked itself into the fabric lining of her bags over the years. One by one, she'd pull out treats. Pistachios roasted with saffron and lime juice. Sour cherry preserves. Sheets of homemade lavashak. Plum leather so sour it made my cheeks hurt. Growing up, I learned from my family to delight in sour foods and let my palate become the most Persian part of me. But it wasn't until I left home that I realized that there's so much more to acid than just the pucker. As part of my parents' ongoing efforts to delay our assimilation for as long as possible, we never celebrated Thanksgiving. I first celebrated the holiday in college with a friend and her family. I loved the hubbub involved in preparing and gathering for the meal, but the actual eating part of Thanksgiving was kind of a letdown. We sat down to a table piled high with food, a humongous whole turkey, roasted and ceremoniously carved, brown gravy made with the drippings, mashed potatoes thick with butter and cream, creamed spinach spiced with nutmeg, Brussels sprouts boiled so long that my friend's nearly toothless grandmother could easily chew them, and stuffing packed with sausage, bacon, and chestnuts. I really love to eat, but these soft, rich, bland foods bored my palate after just a few bites. Spooning more cranberry sauce onto my plate each time the bowl passed my way, I kept eating in hope of tasting something satisfying. But it never happened, and every year on the fourth Thursday of November, I ate until I felt mildly ill, like everyone else. Once I started cooking at Chez Panisse, I began to spend the holiday with friends from the restaurant. At my first Thanksgiving with other cooks, my palate never became bored. I never felt like eating was a chore. I never felt sick afterward. This certainly wasn't because the foods we'd cooked were somehow healthier or more virtuous. So what was it? It hit me that the Thanksgiving dinners I'd spent with other cooks mirrored the traditional Persian meals I'd grown up eating. Acid had been tucked into every dish, and it had brought the meal to life. Sour cream lent a tang to mashed potatoes. A splash of white wine added just before serving lightened the gravy. Hidden in the big, beautiful mass of stuffing among torn sourdough croutons, greens, and bites of sausage were prunes soaked in white wine, secret caches of acid most welcome. Roasted winter squash and Brussels sprouts were tossed in an Italian agrodolce, a sauce made with sugar, chilies, and vinegar. The salsa verde featured fried sage, a welcome partner to the cranberry quince sauce that I'd made with a nod to the Persian quince preserves Maman jarred every autumn. Even dessert, with a drizzle of dark caramel for the pies and a touch of creme fraiche folded into the whipped cream, had a tang. It dawned on me that the reason why everyone spoons so much cranberry sauce over everything at Thanksgiving is that on most tables, it's just about the only form of acid available. I began to see that the true value of acid is not its pucker, but rather balance. Acid grants the palate relief and makes food more appealing by offering contrast. Soon after, I learned another of acid's secrets. Late one morning at Chez Panisse, I was rushing to finish a batch of carrot soup in time for lunch. Like most of the soups we served in the cafe, it was pretty simple. I sweated onions in olive oil and butter. I peeled and sliced the carrots and added them to the pot once the onions were soft. I submerged the vegetables in stock, seasoned with salt, and simmered the soup until everything was tender. Then I blended the contents of the pot into a velvety puree and adjusted the salt. It tasted perfect. I brought a spoonful to Russ, the eternally boyish chef, as he rushed upstairs for the menu meeting with the servers. He tasted it and, without pausing to turn around, said, "Add a capful of vinegar to the pot before you bring it up." Vinegar? Who'd ever thought of putting vinegar in soup? Was Russ crazy? Did I hear him right? I didn't want to ruin the entire pot, so I took a spoonful of my beautiful soup and added a single drop of red wine vinegar. Tasting it, I was floored. I'd expected the vinegar to turn the soup into a sweet and sour abomination. Instead, the vinegar acted like a prism, revealing the soup's nuanced flavors. I could taste the butter and oil, the onions and stock, even the sugar and minerals within the carrots. If blindfolded and quizzed, never in a million years would I have been able to identify vinegar as one of the ingredients. But now, if something I cooked and seasoned ever tasted so dull again, I'd know exactly what was missing. Just as I'd learned to constantly evaluate a dish for salt, now I knew I needed to always taste for acid, too. It was finally clear to me. Acid is salt's alter ego. While salt enhances flavors, acid balances them. By acting as a foil to salt, fat, sugar, and starch, acid makes itself indispensable to everything we cook. What is acid? Technically, any substance that registers below 7 on the pH scale is an acid. I don't have a working pH meter in my kitchen. I broke mine while testing everything for the book. And I'm guessing you don't either. No matter. We've all got a much handier acid sensor. A tongue. Anything that tastes sour is a source of acid. In cooking, acid usually comes in the form of lemon juice, vinegar, or wine. But like fat, acid has myriad sources. Anything fermented, from cheese and sourdough bread to coffee and chocolate, will lend a pleasant tang to your food, as will most fruits, including that vegetable-posing chameleon, the tomato. Acid and flavor. Acid's effect on flavor. The term mouth-watering has long been a synonym for delicious. Foods that are the most enjoyable to eat cause our mouths to water, that is, to produce saliva. Of the 5 basic tastes, acid makes our mouths water the most. When we eat anything sour, our mouths flood with saliva to balance out the acidity, as it's dangerous for our teeth. The more acidic the food, the more saliva rushes in. Acid, then, is an integral part of many of our most pleasurable eating experiences. Yet on its own, acid isn't particularly gratifying. It's the way acid contrasts with other tastes that heightens our pleasure in foods. Like salt, acid heightens other flavors. But it works a bit differently. While the salt threshold is absolute, acid balance is relative. Think of seasoning a simple pot of broth with salt. When the salt concentration passes a certain point, the broth will become inedible. The only way to salvage the broth is to add more unseasoned liquid to reduce the salt concentration, increasing the total volume considerably. Acid balance is different. Think of making lemonade. Measure out the lemon juice, water, and sugar, but mix together only the lemon juice and water. Take a sip, and it will taste unpalatably sour. Then, add the sugar and taste again. It'll be delicious. Yet the lemonade is no less acidic. The pH, or measure of acidity, remains constant after the sugar is added. The acidity is simply balanced by sweetness. And sugar isn't acid's only counterpoint. Salt, fat, bitterness and starch also invariably benefit from the welcome contrast of acid. The flavor of acid. Pure acid tastes sour. Nothing less, nothing more. Sourness isn't necessarily pleasant or unpleasant. Taste a drop of distilled white vinegar, the stuff we all keep around for household tasks like unclogging drains and cleaning the stove. You'll see it's more or less flavorless. It just tastes sour. Many of the delicious flavors we associate with acidic ingredients, for example, the distinctive fruity tang of a wine or the funkiness of a cheese, result from how these ingredients are produced. Everything from the type of wine used to make a vinegar or the kind of milk or bacteria used to make a cheese will affect the flavors of these acidic ingredients. Even the same cheese, aged for different lengths of time, will taste more acidic and complex in flavor, which is why we call a young cheddar mild and an aged one sharp. Acids from different sources vary not only in flavor, but also in concentration, all vinegars are not equally acidic, nor is the acidity of citrus juice consistent. In John McPhee's 1966 book, Oranges, the literary journalist illustrates how natural elements affect flavor. First, he explains how the acidity of oranges diminishes with an orchard's increasing proximity to the equator. One particular Brazilian variety is practically acid-free. He goes on to describe in characteristic detail how not only the location of a tree, but the location of an orange on a tree will affect flavor. Ground fruit, the orange that one can reach and pick from the ground, is not as sweet as fruit that grows high on the tree. Outside fruit is sweeter than inside fruit. Oranges grown on the south side of a tree are sweeter than oranges grown on the east or west sides, and oranges grown on the north side are the least sweet of the lot. Beyond this, there are differentiations of quality inside a single orange. Individual segments vary from one another in their content of acid and sugar. When orange pickers eat an orange, they eat the sweeter blossom half and throw the rest of the orange away. These kinds of natural variations mean you can't know whether your orange is as acidic, ripe, or sweet as the one the recipe tester used in some distant kitchen. I once spent an entire summer making and canning sauce with early girl tomatoes from a friend's farm. Every single batch I made was different from the last. Some tomatoes were watery, others were more flavorful. Some were sweet, others were more acidic. Any recipe I might have written for the sauce the first week of the summer would have been completely inaccurate by the last week. And these were all the same variety of tomatoes from the same farm. This is another reason why you can't always rely solely on recipes in the kitchen. Instead, taste as you go, develop a sense for acid balance, and trust your instincts. Acids of the world. Many iconic dishes are defined by their particular acids. A peanut butter sandwich, for example, suffers without the tang jelly provides. No proper Brit would consider eating a plate of fish and chips without malt vinegar. Imagine carnitas tacos without a spoonful of salsa, or xiaolong bao, the classic soup dumplings of Shanghai, served with anything other than Chinese black vinegar. Just as with cooking fats, acid can change the direction of a dish. So let geography and tradition guide your choice of which one to use. Vinegars. In general, a region's vinegar reflects its agriculture. Italy, France, Germany, and Spain, countries known for wine production, make good use of wine vinegars in their cooking. Choose sherry vinegar for romesco, the Catalonian sauce made with peppers and toasted nuts, champagne vinegar for mignonette sauce to serve with oysters, and red wine vinegar to dress radicchio and make blaukraut, the classic German braised red cabbage. On the other hand, rice vinegar is a staple in many Asian countries, from Thailand and Vietnam to Japan and China. Brits and Germans turn to apple cider vinegar to dress salads, as do cooks in the American South. Southerners also have an affinity for cane vinegar, which is also the acid of choice in the Philippines, where sugarcane is a major crop. Citrus. When it comes to citrus, lemon trees are well suited to the coastal climates in Mediterranean countries. So choose lemon to squeeze into tabbouleh and hummus and over grilled octopus, Nicoise salad, or Sicilian fennel and orange salad. Lime trees, on the other hand, grow more readily in tropical climates. So limes are the preferred citrus everywhere from Mexico and Cuba to India, Vietnam, and Thailand. Use limes in guacamole, pho gras, green papaya salad, and cachumbar, the Indian answer to pico de gallo. One form of citrus you should never use, though, is bottled citrus juice. Made from concentrate and doctored with preservatives and citrus oils, it tastes bitter and doesn't offer any of the clean, bright flavor of fresh-squeezed juice. Pickles. From Indian achar to Iranian torshi, from Korean kimchi to Japanese sukemono, from German sauerkraut to chow chow in the American South, every culture has its pickles. A few slices of steak can easily become a bowl of Korean bibimbap if piled high with kimchi, or they can become a taco with a few pickled carrots and jalapenos, depending on what's in the fridge.